Thanks for joining us. I'm Susan Page of USA Today, sitting in for Diane Rehm. She's having a voice treatment. The top U.S. commander in Iraq says he expects to draw down American troop levels slightly over the next several months. A bigger reduction will come after Iraq's elections in January. The IMF says the world has turned a corner toward economic recovery, but the international agency warns that credit remains tight and nations need to implement additional regulatory reforms. And Iran shows surprising willingness to address concerns over its nuclear program. Joining me for the second hour of our Friday News Roundup, Barbara Slavin of The Washington Times. Welcome, Barbara.
Thanks, Susan. Good to be here.
Jonathan Landay of McClatchy Newspapers. Thanks for being with us.
My pleasure.
And joining us for the first time on the News Roundup, David Loin of the BBC.
Hi, Susan.
Thank you so much for joining with us.
Great pleasure.
He's the author of a new book. It's called In Afghanistan, 200 Years of British, Russian, and American Occupation.
Feels like we've been there a long time.
Well, let's start with Afghanistan. A little bit of a surprise this morning. President Obama met in Copenhagen aboard Air Force One with General McChrystal. Why that meeting?
It's hard to say because they just had a meeting at the White House in the context of the National Security Council on whatever strategy the president decides he's going to pursue in Afghanistan. But the timing of the meeting is curious. The White House says that it was previously scheduled, but yesterday in London, General McChrystal delivered a speech in which it appeared he criticized the other strategy that's competing against the one that he's pursuing that is being promoted chiefly by Vice President Biden, and basically saying that this strategy, known as counterterrorism, won't work in Afghanistan.
Well, David, tell us, what's the debate over when it comes to what path to take ahead?
Well, the real problem with this counterterrorism idea is that it was what was tried in 2001. For Joe Biden to be coming back now and saying, let's, you know, pursue al-Qaeda and let's not try and rebuild Afghanistan, that's just the failed policy that happened right at the beginning. You know, the U.S. lost no troops in toppling the Taliban in 2001. As we know, they've lost more than 800 in the years since. And my country's losing a lot of troops as well. Most of them since 2006, when the real fight was taken to the Taliban. The counterterrorism strategy failed during all those years, and now, you know, the generals are back and fighting a different kind of war, counterterrorism, a counterinsurgency war, and needing new tools to do the job.
Now, a counterterrorism strategy, Barbara, would focus maybe not so much on Afghanistan, maybe focus more on the areas in Pakistan.
Well, it would be focused on al-Qaeda. Of course, al-Qaeda's leadership is in Pakistan, not in Afghanistan, although there are some al-Qaeda elements in Afghanistan. But where the argument falls down is that if you lose Afghanistan to the Taliban, al-Qaeda can come back, can make it a safe haven again, can use it not only as a springboard for attacks on the United States, but to infiltrate other countries in the area and Central Asia and so on. What's interesting about this whole McChrystal business, though, is that he's been skating very close to the edge. There have been a lot of rumors that he's threatened to resign if he doesn't get 40,000, maybe even more troops. He gave this very tough speech in London, and then Obama goes and sees him. Now, the meeting that Jonathan mentioned, McChrystal took part in it via video conference. This was face-to-face. So I would have loved to have been a fly on the wall and heard what the president had to say to McChrystal and vice versa.
Well, Jonathan, do you think the commander-in-chief was unhappy to have his general out there in London talking to a think tank, basically opposing the strategy proposed by his vice president?
Well, I can't imagine he's very happy. But again, it's very hard to talk about, you know, exactly what the president wanted to see General McChrystal about, because as the White House is saying, this meeting was previously scheduled once the two of them found out that they were going to be in close proximity. The president being in Copenhagen to promote Chicago as being the site of the 2016 Olympics. But going back to the whole question of the debate that's going on here, and if, you know, the idea that if the United States fails in Afghanistan, al-Qaeda can come back and use Afghanistan again as a sanctuary to launch attacks against the United States and its allies. I mean, that is a consideration, but that as a consideration, at least the way I see things, has become a minor consideration given the parlous state of affairs in Afghanistan right now. The real stakes, and that's not what's being talked about here, is basically the future stability of that entire region, the future of Afghanistan, its viability as a multi-ethnic state, the possibility that a return of the Taliban and a new civil war there could bring India and Pakistan into a proxy war backing opposite sides, and they have nuclear weapons, the possibility or the probability of further destabilization of nuclear-armed Pakistan, and the fact is that the Taliban has infiltrated now into two northern provinces of Afghanistan, and from there, they could very easily begin trying to export or helping al-Qaeda export its violent Islamic ideology across the borders into Central Asia, where the dictatorships for the last 20 years have basically been brutally repressing moderate Islam, so that there is fertile ground in Central Asia now for extremist Islam.
And yet some of the officials who support some new path in Afghanistan would argue, that, David, that the history of empires that go into Afghanistan is not a happy one, that nation building may be a fool's errand in Afghanistan. What would you say to them?
Well, it's a really easy one. This is the graveyard of empires. It is, I mean, my book goes back 200 years. It was 1809 was the very first British envoy who went into Afghanistan. It took 30 years before there was a war, and it was the biggest hiding that the British Empire ever had, the loss of 16,000 men, women and children in the slaughter in the Khyber Pass. So it was a country that Britain remembered from very early in the 19th century. And one of the really interesting things that I picked up in my researches, which I think some other people had missed, was quite how far back Islamic fundamentalism goes in being a way of bringing the nation against a foreign invader. And I think it's taken the USA a long time to realize that. I mean, as we know, during the 1980s, the USA funded Islamic fundamentalists in order to destroy the Russians, because the communist empire was then the big threat internationally. And you can see the justification for that at the time. But if you look back to the wars of the 19th century, I mean, if you read Winston Churchill's book, the young Winston Churchill was a war correspondent in the 1897 frontier conflict, believe it or not, extraordinarily precocious 22-year-old. And he identifies among some of the toughest of their opponents some people called the Taliban, who were Islamic warriors, who were fundamentalist students, who lived, he said, with the people and lived on, at the expense of the people, as I've seen the Taliban when I've traveled with them in Afghanistan doing. So this goes back a long way. And this fundamentalism for nationalism in Afghanistan is something which I think the international community is only now in the 21st century realizing is something that is deep in those people.
Barbara. Just quick addition to that, we had Pervez Musharraf, the former Pakistani leader, in for a newsmaker interview at the Washington Times this week. And when he talked about the Taliban, he said, they live on bread and onions. Yeah. They have no logistical needs, logistical tail.
I traveled with them when they took Kabul in 1996. They were fast, flexible, and absolutely just living literally off the land, living off the villages they were in. And they're the same in Helmand now. I was with them a couple of years ago in a slightly controversial Taliban embed, as it were, in 2006. And the same thing. They live, in a very poor way, at the expense of local people, but they do have some significant local support, particularly in the poorer areas, Pashtun areas of the south of Afghanistan.
Our phone lines are open. You can give us a call at 1-800-433-8850 or send us an email at drshow@wamu.org. Well, Jonathan, some Americans may listen to this discussion and say, well, what in the world are we doing there then? There is a weariness, I think, toward the Afghanistan war among many Americans.
Well, absolutely. Of course. And it's not just the Afghanistan war. It's the war in Iraq as well. 8 years of constant war is not a good thing. It's costing a lot of blood and treasure. The thing is, though, some people would argue that we would not find ourselves in the perilous position that we find ourselves now today in Afghanistan if American energy, resources, and troops hadn't been diverted to Iraq. I've been going to Afghanistan ever since the fall of the Taliban. I was there beginning 5 days after they left Kabul. And the fact is that for the first time in Afghan history, a foreign military was welcomed in that country. And there were at least two or three years there where there was a possibility of creating or at least bringing to Afghanistan the kinds of things that we're trying to do now, albeit trying to fight an insurgency at the same time. Back then, there was no insurgency, and we've lost, squandered 7 precious years.
It was absolutely an opportunity lost.
Jonathan, Peter Galbraith was fired as a deputy UN envoy to Afghanistan this week. Why?
Well, it goes back to, of course, the election, the presidential election on August 20th, which was just replete with fraud, violence, and other malfeasance that was going on. Mr. Galbraith tried to intervene when, on learning that the so-called Independent Election Commission of Afghanistan, which is actually appointed by President Karzai, was going to junk a bunch of very tough standards that were designed to weed out bad votes, suspect votes, all for Mr. Karzai. When he found that was going to, and he found out that they were going to do that after determining that if they weeded out those votes, Mr. Karzai would have to go to a second round. He tried to intervene. Mr. Karzai found out about it, complained about foreign interference in the vote counting, went to Mr. Galbraith's boss, Kai Eide, a Norwegian diplomat, and Mr. Eide sided with President Karzai.
Jonathan Landay is a national security and intelligence correspondent for McClatchy Newspapers. And we're also joined this hour by Barbara Slavin, assistant managing editor for World and National Security at The Washington Times, and David Loyne, foreign correspondent for the BBC, author of In Afghanistan, a new book that's just out. We're going to take a short break. When we come back, we'll go to the phones and take some of your calls and questions, and we'll talk about the situation in Iran. Stay with us. Welcome back. I'm Susan Page of USA Today, sitting in for Diane Rehm. And it's the second hour of our news roundup. With us, Barbara Slavin of The Washington Times, Jonathan Landay of McClatchy Newspapers, David Loyne of the BBC. Boy, some surprising news, Barbara, yesterday out of Geneva in the talks with Iran. Tell us what happened.
Well, the Obama administration is really sly. I'm beginning to see how they choreograph and manipulate these things. They were, you know, downplaying expectations. They were predicting a big bust-up with the Iranians. The Iranians were talking tough. They were firing off missiles. And lo and behold, they get an agreement. And it's not a bad agreement. It's not entirely what the world wants of Iran, which is to suspend its uranium enrichment. But the deal that they reached would send about 75% of the low-enriched uranium that Iran has already made out of the country to Russia to be reprocessed. And then it would be sent back to be used in a reactor that produces medical isotopes for dealing with things like cancer, a facility that is under the inspection of the International Atomic Energy Agency. So what this does is it diminishes the chance that Iran could make a bomb. It puts off at least the timetable for that, and it gives some more space for diplomacy and more negotiations, What's more, you had a 45-minute one-on-one between Bill Burns, the Undersecretary of State for Political Affairs, and Saeed Jalili, the top Iranian negotiator. And this is the first openly acknowledged, substantive, high-level, no-holes-barred conversation between the U.S. and Iran in 30 years. So it's not a bad day's work. Now, I mean, there are a lot of skeptics. Iran may be hiding other facilities. The U.S. just revealed that they had a secret enrichment plant that had not yet started up. There may be other facilities we don't know about. You know, Iran is a master at playing games with the IAEA. But it's given the expectations and the atmosphere going in. It's not bad.
David, do you see this as a breakthrough?
I think there are two key bits to this. One is, isn't it different, the U.S. administration and the way it's playing in the world? You know, I was at an Afghan summit, in fact, in The Hague in the spring of this year when Dick Holbrooke happened to bump into a senior Iranian in the corridor, happened to shake his hand, you know, didn't they discuss anything? I mean, it's a totally different way that that America is doing business internationally, and it's being noticed, and of course it's having results. Russia was the key part of this, getting Russia on board, persuading Russia, particularly over the Middle East negotiations, Palestine-Israel negotiations, that that America was not going to go completely all the way on the Zionist side, persuading Russia that there was some other way through on this was absolutely part of it, and now getting Russia to bring this uranium to be properly enriched in Russia rather than abroad. It's a coup, and the other key part of it is the discovery of this second installation at COM, this other secret enrichment plant, which Britain and the United States have known about for several months. This was intelligence work that brought this forward, and it was only at the UN last week that they were able to sort of reveal that actually we know you've got this other second plant, and they shook this deal out.
What it reveals is a lot of diplomatic preparation. You know, you don't get an agreement like this in one day. So that means that our nuclear experts have been passing messages to Iran. There have probably been meetings in Vienna, meetings all over the place that we don't know anything about to set this up. The Russians were key. But it established a very important principle, because the Iranians have always said, we cannot rely on others to enrich uranium for us. We have to be independent. And now they've said, well, we will let the Russians do this. So the Russians must have really put the thumbscrews to Iran and threatened to come on board perhaps with stringent sanctions. Again, what you see is serious diplomacy, well-prepared, going on at a level that, frankly, we haven't seen in a long time.
Mm. Jonathan.
We're going to see in the coming weeks how all this shakes out, because, of course, the big elephant in the room is still what remains, the international demand that Iran suspend its uranium enrichment program. And that is not part of this deal. Now, we will see, as I said, over the coming weeks, whether or not Iran moves in that direction. The other question, of course, is this one facility, this new facility that was found near GOM, may well be part of a chain of secret facilities. There are not many experts out there who believe that this is a facility that sits all by itself and is not related to other facilities of the same kind, enrichment facilities where low-enriched uranium could be enriched to highly enriched uranium, which is the fuel for nuclear weapons. Nevertheless, given the very low expectations that all the sides built up in the preceding days of these talks in Geneva, it was quite a step forward.
Can we mention the domestic political situation in Iran for a minute? Because the Iranians went into these talks very weak because of the fact that there are still massive opposition to what happened on June the 12th, the elections that supposedly brought us back Mahmoud Ahmadinejad. And, you know, the discovery of this facility in Qom suggests that there's better intelligence, human intelligence probably, as well as satellite intelligence, which means that the regime there may be beginning to crack in a way that we haven't seen before. And this also plays to the advantage of the West as we move forward. It provides more confidence that if there are other secret facilities, the West might actually find out about them, that there might be some nuclear scientists, you know, cooperating with Western intelligence. So it's also, look, it's the first time in 30 years that you actually have this kind of negotiation going on. And And that in itself is extraordinary, even if Jonathan's right, even if they don't suspend enrichment, even if it turns out to be a, you know, a prolonged game that doesn't lead to the results that we would want.
But amidst all this optimism, the other side of a regime that may be cracking is that there are many different power circles within Iran, and who controls the nuclear weapons, who controls the power enrichment? Can Ahmadinejad's team, you know, Larijani in particular, can he deliver that back in Tehran? Can they, you know, say to all these other different groups, the Revolutionary Guard, and indeed the people in Qom, who are the clerical establishment, that, you know, this is a deal that Iran needs to go down, otherwise there's going to be crippling economic sanctions. I mean, you know, sanctions are something that this proud empire, this ancient civilization, as the Iranians will always tell you they are, does not like having threatened against it. So this could easily turn bad.
Let's go to the phones and invite some of our listeners to join our conversation. You can reach us at 1-800-433-8850. Let's go to Kobe calling us from Elkhart, Indiana. Hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Yes, go ahead.
And actually, your conversation was a great segue into my question is twofold. One, do you think there's more going on behind the scenes to influence the political direction in Iran than we're aware of, meaning from our government or others? And additionally, is that possibly a better way to go about trying to thwart the nuclear ambitions of this regime that we cannot trust?
All right. Thanks so much for your call.
If you mean whether there's support for the democratic movement in Iran, I think there is, but it's in a more subtle way. We don't have axis of evil speeches and a lot of rhetorical tub-thumping like we did under the Bush administration, but there is support for Internet access for Iranians, proxy servers that they can use to communicate with each other about the protests, the demonstrations that are going on, continuing to go on in Iran. I mean, just this past week, there were students at Tehran University, other universities, which have just opened up for the fall, and they're yelling death to the dictator, and they're getting away with it. The Iranians also released a couple of political prisoners this week, which suggested that they're beginning to feel the heat. So I think, you know, there are a lot of arguments about how to do this. The CIA was able to overthrow a government in Iran in 1953, but it's a long time since then. They couldn't save the Shah in 1979, and so there are other ways. And if the Iranian government can no longer blame the United States, see the United States as overtly hostile, if it's engaged in negotiations with the United States, that in some ways makes life easier for the political opposition within Iran.
All right, Kobe, thanks for your call. Let's go to Raleigh, North Carolina, and talk to Patricia. Patricia, you're on the air.
Thank you. I'm here. I have a question for Mr. Loyne based upon his research of the 19th century Afghanistan frontier. Can he draw any parallels or comparisons with what we know happened on our U.S. frontier at about that time, particularly with the activity of the light cavalry involving the American Plains Indians?
Well, Patricia, what a question! How interesting!
Wonderful comparison between the cavalry in the plains of America and what's going on in the Northwest frontier at the moment. I mean, interestingly, there is a very precise historical parallel between what was going on in the United States in the 19th century and what Russia was doing in that region. The Russians justified their expansion right across Central Asia, right down to the Oxus River, to the north of Afghanistan, because they were doing just what the United States was doing in civilizing the tribes on their borders. So they took vast swathes of what's now Kazakhstan, using the political justification. It was a Prince Gorchakov, who I talk about in my book, who put this policy together. So the Russians then took a century before they actually crossed the Oxus River. The great fear was that they would move across and be the next player in the great game. But I think the difference is the terrain. I mean, you're talking about American plains where cavalry can operate. The Northwest Frontier is a mountain range which is 400 miles long, 200 miles wide in places. There are mountains going up there to 16,000, 17,000 feet. And in that 400-mile chain of mountains, there are only three useful passes, the most famous being the Khyber Pass, that military can cross. The rest of it, the British counted 108 other passes. So there are other ways of crossing the hills. And, of course, the the Afghans, the Pashtun tribes who've never accepted the frontier, know how they can cross that that land. But that is, you're absolutely right, Patricia, that is the most crucial part of this game. It's not about fighting the Taliban in Helmand. It's about defeating Islamic fundamentalism in the northwest frontier itself. And with that, we have a difficult ally, Pakistan. You know, Pakistani intelligence still in many ways supporting their previous proxies in the Taliban and other fundamentalist movements. And fighting it is very different from fighting with the cavalry in the plains.
And Patricia, I think you get the prize for most interesting question during the news round. Jonathan.
And it's interesting what David said, because in the various strategies that we're seeing discussed and debated here within the Obama administration, the big hole that you can drive a truck through in all of them is what to do about Pakistan and what to do about continuing support by elements of the Pakistani military and intelligence for the Taliban and for other extremist groups who are allied with the Taliban.
I'm Susan Page, and you're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. We're taking your calls at 1-800-433-8850. We'll talk now to Tim. He's been holding on from Boca Raton, Florida. Tim, hi.
Good morning, and thank you for taking my call.
Yes, go ahead.
I have a question. As I listen to Iran, when I listen to some of the American coverage of Iran, my question is, how do we discuss, how do we place so much emphasis on Iran's nuclear program here in America and not discuss Israel's nuclear weapons program, especially in light of some of the threats that have been made by both Israel and Iran toward each other? But how is it that we not discuss Israel's nuclear weapons program in this country?
All right, Tim, thanks so much for your call.
Thank you, Tim. On the front page of the Washington Times, or at www.washingtontimes.com, you will find a very interesting story. Last May, when Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu came to the White House for the first time, he got President Obama to give him in writing a reaffirmation of a 40-year-old understanding between the United States and Israel that's kind of like don't ask, don't tell. Basically, the U.S. does not push Israel to open up its nuclear weapons to inspection as long as Israel doesn't admit it has them and doesn't test them. And Israel is believed to have about 200, some say even more, nuclear warheads. So, you know, the U.S. has this deal with the Israelis. The Israelis argue that they need this nuclear deterrent because of the fact that they're surrounded by potentially hostile states. And Israel has not threatened Iran's existence. It's said that Iran is threatening it and that it's prepared to defend itself.
Jonathan. There's another major difference here, and that is that Israel is not a party to the Non-Proliferation Treaty, under which there is this, it is the cornerstone of the international non-proliferation regime aimed at preventing the spread of nuclear weapons. And this, it entails this bargain. And what the bargain is that the five nuclear powers will move towards eliminating them, and of course they not really been doing that, in return for non-nuclear states only using nuclear power for nuclear technology for peaceful purposes. And Iran is a member of the NPT, and it had specific agreements with the policemen of the NPT, that's the International Atomic Energy Agency, under that it violated. Under these agreements, it was supposed to tell the IAEA about all of its nuclear programs. And the fact is that it hid its enrichment program, the program that can be used not just to make fuel for power plants, but also for nuclear weapons. It hid that program from the IAEA for 18 years. And now it's been disclosed. They also hid this second enrichment plant from the IAEA for how many years? We're not sure. At least four, it appears. And that is also in violation of an agreement with the IAEA that says that Iran must tell the IAEA before it starts constructing nuclear plants that it is doing so. Now, Iran disagrees with that interpretation, but the fact is that the IAEA, the United States, the UN, and everyone, all the other parties, believe that Iran has indeed violated that understanding as well.
Yeah, Tim, two brief points. The first is that Israel, of course, has carried out air attacks. I mean, Jonathan says they haven't threatened with nuclear weapons, but they have carried out air attacks on a number of neighboring countries who have been trying to put together technology they don't like. But you're absolutely right that the international community is broadly wanting Israel to declare its nuclear weapons. And the big powers are skating on thin ice at the United Nations, an organization where most countries believe that there is an inequality in the way that the big powers who are dealing with the Permanent Five and Germany, who are dealing with this issue, are dealing with it. And they see it as unequal.
Barbara? Well, the Israelis were nervous about what Obama would do, frankly, because of his support for nonproliferation and a world without nuclear weapons. So it was very important for them to get this agreement in writing from President Obama, that at least for now they can go on with this this situation. I mean, yes, they're not part of the NPT, but that begs the question of why aren't they part of the NPT and shouldn't they be part of the NPT?
And why aren't they part of the NPT?
They have a doctrine which says basically that they are going to have this covert nuclear program until all of their the hostile states in the area have peace agreements with them, and they can be sure that no other power in the area has nuclear weapons.
It's a unilateral doctrine.
Which makes sense if you're Israeli, but it still, let's face it, is considered a double standard by others in the region.
Barbara Slavin, she's the author of a book called Bitter Friends, Bosom Enemies. It deals with U.S. policy toward Iran. Jonathan Landay from McClatchy Newspapers and David Loyne from the BBC. His new book, which we've been talking about, is called In Afghanistan, 200 Years of British, Russian, and American Occupation. We're going to take another very short break. When we come back, we'll talk about the situation in Iraq and the election developments there. And we'll take your calls and questions. You can call us 1-800-433-8850. Send us a question on Facebook or Twitter. Stay with us.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by American University, by Global Nutritional Research, maker of Clotamin, a multivitamin designed for people on blood thinners, at clotamin.com, by the estate of Richard Leroy Walters, whose life was enriched by NPR and whose bequest seeks to encourage others to discover public radio, and by Ford Foundation, working with visionaries on the front lines of social change worldwide, at fordfoundation.org. This is NPR.
Jackknife with a precious load, spills its guts all over the road.
Singer and guitarist Richard Thompson has a new box set that collects over 40 years of his work. On the next Fresh Air, we feature excerpts of our interviews and concerts with him. Join us. Steady now.
The International Monetary Fund issued its semi-annual report on global financial stability this week. Kind of a mixed picture, Jonathan. What did they say?
Well, it was a mixed picture. The IMF reported that actually revised downward the amount of losses suffered by the global economy because of the crisis by about $600 billion.
So that's good news.
That's the good news. On the other hand, of course, it said that, and it also said, you know, there are indications that the world economy is turning the corner. But at the same time, it notes that there are still serious problems with the banking industry, particularly in the U.S. and Western Europe, that banks still carrying huge piles of losses on their books, that they're finding it hard to find new sources of credit. The report also says, similarly, that households and private businesses are also carrying huge piles of debt that they remain concerned about, and governments that have implemented these unprecedented intervention programs are also carrying very large piles of debt on their books. At the same time, it also warns that now is not the time for complacency. There still needs to be financial reform. There still needs to be measures taken by the governments to ensure that they remain engaged in this, in managing the economy, their interventions, and not to end those interventions too early.
David, you're based in London. I think here in the United States, there's a sense that we're beginning to get into a recovery, but it's a fragile one, and it's maybe a jobless recovery, which leaves a lot of people feeling like the recovery's not very good for them. What is the sense, do you think, in Europe about what's happening with the global economy?
Well, the UK stock market has just had its best 3 months since the early 1990s, literally. There's a real herd thing that's back in that. I mean, is there any fundamental reason why the British economy is suddenly better than it was? Probably not. But the buyers are back. So there's a real sense that of relief. Maybe we've got over this. The G20 met in London at the beginning of the year. The British Prime Minister Gordon Brown claims.
And in Pittsburgh just a couple of weeks ago.
Absolutely. And I think you're now seeing what this financial crisis has done. I mean, that the Pittsburgh meeting was the next key part of this. Is a new global architecture emerging, where actually what happens in Europe, and with respect, what happens in the United States, albeit it is still the largest single economy in the world, doesn't matter as much as what happens in China, India, Brazil, Russia, the so-called BRIC countries, Brazil, Russia, India, China. And the really interesting thing about the IMF report was that the key element in pulling the global economy out of not being quite as bad as it might have been next year is China's growth.
Barbara?
Yeah, it said that it predicted that there would be 5% GDP growth in 2010, up from 1.75% in 2009, and that it would be largely driven by China and India, not the anemic West.
In Iraq this week, we had the prime minister announce a broad coalition for the elections in January. A little bit of a change in strategy on his part, Jonathan.
Absolutely. This is a man who led a party called the Dawa Party, which was a conservative Shiite party aligned with the other Shiite parties in Iraq. And what he seems to be doing, what al-Maliki seems to be doing, is trying to harness what is a very dissatisfaction, discontent with religious parties in Iraq, among many Iraqis who see the religious parties as being part and parcel of the violence that was unleashed after the 2003 U.S. invasion. He calls his new party the State of Law Bloc. He's casting it as being non-sectarian, secular, and embracing not just Shiites, but also Sunnis, as well as Kurds and other minorities in Iraq. The thing, though, being that at this point, really, it doesn't appear there are any really major leaders from those other groups that have joined his party. Nevertheless, he himself went up to Kurdistan to try and bring the major Kurdish parties into his coalition. Right now, that may not be happening because there's still no agreement on the future of Kirkuk, the oil-rich city that the Kurds and the Arabs all claim. And he's also facing opposition from a conservative Shiite bloc that has the backing of many of Iraq's Shiite religious leaders.
Meanwhile, we heard from General Odierno, who's the U.S. commander in Iraq, about troop levels. Mm-hmm. Barbara, what did he say about when more American troops could come home?
Well, he had a pretty optimistic report, and one thing also is good. Apparently, civilian casualties are down in Iraq this month after a pretty horrific, rather in September compared to August when there were some horrific bombings. That seems to have stopped, at least for now, or at least it's less than it was. So Odierno is saying that he can bring back an additional 4,000 troops by the end of October that he hadn't expected. There are about 124,000 American troops still in Iraq now, so that would bring the U.S. down to about 120,000. And he's also said that he will meet the goal of having only 50,000 U.S. troops in Iraq by September 2010. Now, this obviously is good news at a time when the Obama administration is weighing whether to send more forces to Afghanistan, so it may have a little bit more room here to maneuver on that.
Although 50,000 troops still a significant U.S. presence there.
It is, but, you know, it's most of these people will be trainers, will be working in sort of liaison capacities with the Iraqis, and the Iraqis very much are taking the lead now on policing their own country.
In Indianapolis, we're joined by Alex. Alex, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me. I don't want to take back the conversation too far, but David, I got a question for you. I understand that you were embedded with the Taliban, and I was wondering how you were able to achieve that. I understand the Taliban is very anti-Western, very anti, and had very anti-Western rhetoric. How were you able, as a Western reporter, to get access to that?
Round about the spring of 2006, they reorganized themselves in Quetta, where their leadership is, into a sort of political wing and a financial wing that raised money and a military wing. And they said, and the way the invitation came, they said that they felt that they'd last time they were in power, they'd got their public relations a little bit wrong, which you know, given the fact that they were the perhaps the least liked administration anywhere in the world, particularly by women, was a sort of understatement of the year. But a very competent Afghan producer who I've worked with over a number of years heard this comment coming back, and he went to meet them. And they said, well, look, you know, some of their older people remember that I was with them. I was the only foreign journalist who was with them when they took Kabul in 1996. I was traveling with them. And he took a DVD of that report and showed that, you know, I could be trusted to not bring in an airstrike if I was with them. And I negotiated, and I went back to the BBC, and I said the Taliban want to take me into Helmand for a few days, and you can imagine what my employers said. But once I'd negotiated between these two power blocks, the BBC had some security questions, and in the end, it took 3 or 4 months. But I went to Kandahar, and a guy turned up at my hotel early in the morning and put me in a taxi, and I went and spent a few days with them.
And what do you think you learned that was not possible to... What did you gain that you couldn't have gained by not embedding?
I talked to their military commander, their then military commander, who was killed 3 or 4 months later in just the very thing that I feared, which was an airstrike, you know, from a spy telling people where he was. They were moving. He was moving all of the time. And the conversation I had with him gave me an insight into exactly what it was that they felt that they were doing. He was an idealist nationalist Afghan who felt that the war had gone on for too long and wanted to bring a sort of rule to Afghanistan that you might not like, but which many Afghans feel only works with the sort of conservative, traditional ways that they are.
All right, Alex, thanks very much for your call. We have a caller who asks if there's linkage between the Russians agreeing to enrich Iran's uranium and pressure Iran to have that happen and are not putting missiles in Poland, that defense system that the Bush administration pursued. Barbara, you're nodding your head.
Yeah, I mean, this is all part of the diplomacy that's been going on now very carefully for months. When the Obama administration agreed not to put those missile defense components in Eastern and Central Europe, that was a huge thing for the Russians. And I think it has convinced them that Obama really does want to cooperate with him on a number of issues. It's made it much easier for them to justify, even domestically, doing things that are seen as helping the U.S. But in terms of this business with Iran, the Russians have been offering to enrich uranium for Iran for a long time. They get money for it. It's good for their nuclear industry. And the Russians don't want to see Iran develop a nuclear weapon. So this really fits their interests in many ways.
Jonathan?
Yeah, indeed. There's been a Russian offer on the table for quite a long time to, in fact, set up some kind of multinational undertaking enterprise under which the Russians would enrich Iranian uranium. Now, again, the question is, we're going to see this happen now with about 2,600 pounds of low-enriched uranium that the Iranians have made that is known about. It's going to be then taken, enriched to about 19%, sent to France, where they're going to fabricate it into fuel rods, and then sent back to Iran. What happens next? That is what the big question is.
Some news from Copenhagen. Tokyo has been eliminated in the first round of voting by the International Olympic Committee. So that goes on. This process has been described as a little bit like the Iowa caucuses, where you might have several rounds of voting before you get to the final winner. Well, let's go to South Bend and talk to Makshi. Hi, Makshi.
Hi. I was calling about the Afghan war. And why is it that nobody goes back to the last free Punjab kingdom and the Emperor Ranjit Singh, who subdued the frontier and the Afghans and did it quite easily? I mean, my great-great-grandfather fought in that, and it was for decades, the frontier was peaceful under Ranjit Singh.
Yeah, Makshi, I mean, I like these questions. They play absolutely to my period that I write about in my book. Ranjit Singh stopped at the foot of the mountains. He took all of that land west of the Indus River, you're absolutely right, and he put together the most effective fighting force in Asia, which was significantly stronger than in many ways than the British forces, and they sensibly enough never took on the Sikhs until he died. But he didn't go into the mountains. He stopped at the foot of those frontier mountains.
I'm Susan Page, and you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Well, we have more news from Copenhagen. Chicago has been eliminated.
Oh.
A little bit of a surprise, I think. I think a lot of Americans thought, you send the American president there, he's going to be able to land the Olympic Games.
I was in London when, you know, London's going to be the next Olympics. And the sheer physical excitement on the streets, you know, that the city I was born in, they really wanted the Olympics. And it's still, you know, it's still a thrill, actually, that it's coming. And I'm sorry it's not coming here.
Why? I realize.
I mean, for all the money you lose, yes, and for all that, it's they're rebuilding a part of East London, which was very run down. And I think it's going to be exciting that we're going to get it. But so it's going to go to Rio, I suppose.
You know, we talked about the fact that Barack Obama has had this big success in talks with Iran this week. So is it a kind of rebuke in a way for Chicago not to get the Olympics?
Well, obviously in one way it is, but on the other, I don't think the sending of the Olympics to Chicago would risk undermining American and international security. Of course, it's a big prestigious event, but we're talking about the most prestigious sporting event versus the possibility that a country that is not on good terms with the United States may be developing nuclear weapons.
America's had the Olympics quite a lot.
Well, this not for 20 years, though. Well, we'll see how this finally ends up in Copenhagen. Now, we know that there were high-level talks this week. We found out this week about high-level talks between a senior U.S. official and the Cuban government in Havana. This doesn't happen so often, Barbara.
No, this has been a real engagement week for the Obama administration. You know, they've been making noises with Burma and with Iran, and now with Cuba. There was a Deputy Assistant Secretary of State named Bisa Williams who spent almost a week in Cuba. And originally she was supposed to go there and just talk about restoring postal service between the U.S. and Cuba, which we haven't had since 1963. But apparently she did a lot more than that. She kind of toured the island. She went and saw some agricultural facilities. She talked to opposition leaders as well. So I think it's evidence of a continuing thaw between the U.S. and Cuba.
What are the limits, though, do you think, in the absence of Fidel Castro leaving the scene, Jonathan, for any real thaw in U.S. relations?
It's interesting because the Government Accountability Office issued a new report yesterday on whether or not or how the president can or the limits that the president has on his ability to lift the number one restriction that the United States keeps on Cuba, and that is its 47-year-old trade embargo. And the fact is that this report says that short of Cuba enacting democratic reforms, which Cuba says is its own business and no one else's, the president has no power to end this trade embargo, and that only Congress can do this. And I counted, there's something like 7 or 8 different laws that apply to U.S. trade with Cuba. And of course, only a couple of countries, I think Israel and Palau, still support that trade embargo.
You know, we have gotten several emailers who raised questions about the real value of the U.S. war in Afghanistan. Here's just one of them. Russ from Princeton, New Jersey says, can someone explain to me how the Taliban having control of large parts of Afghanistan could serve as a springboard for attacks against the United States by al-Qaeda? There might be good reasons for trying to crush the Taliban, but I don't think the springboard metaphor is one of them.
General McChrystal addressed just this very point in his London speech a couple of days ago. And what he said was, and I think I broadly agree with it, that if Afghanistan goes absolutely into the hands of the people like the Taliban, then there's the opportunity for al-Qaeda to operate again. And although you're not talking about planes that take off in Kandahar and bomb America, but you are, and British intelligence reports show that most of the, and we've had faced a number of, as you know, terrorist attacks in London and terrorist threats in Britain in the last 4 or 5 years, most of those originate in the Northwest Frontier. There is very direct intelligence linking those places of real disorder with actual acts that threaten the lives of people in civilized countries.
Jonathan, we'll give you our last
I would
word.
Just point out that 9/11 was an attack on the United States that used Taliban-ruled Afghanistan as a springboard.
Jonathan Landay of McClatchy Newspapers, Barbara Slavin of The Washington Times, and David Loin of the BBC. Thanks so much for joining us this hour on The Diane Rehm Show.
Thanks, Susan.
I'm Susan Page of USA Today, sitting in for Diane Rehm. Thanks for listening.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Jonathan Smith, Susan Neighbors, and Denise Couture. The engineer is Toby Schreiner. Dori Anisman answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives and CD sales, transcripts from SoftScribe, and podcasts. Call 202-885-1200 for more information. Our email address is drshow@wamu.org. This program comes to you from American University in Washington. This is NPR, National Public Radio.